Glenn.
Josh.
Hey.
Hey, my man. How you doing?
Well, mixed. I'm doing...
Oh, you're glad I asked.
I don't have the usual short, yeah. Pretty good. How are you doing? It's been a tough year for both of us, and maybe we should just quickly reintroduce ourselves since it's been a while.
Yeah, let's do it.
So I'm Josh Cohen. I teach political science, philosophy, and law at Stanford, and I'm editor of Boston Review, and I'm also on leave from Stanford for the year, and I'm on the faculty of Apple University, but we won't talk about that.
Oh, it sounds pretty cool, though. Yeah. I'm Glenn Lowry. I teach at Brown University, professor of economics and public policy there.
So...
And longtime Blogging Heads participant, Josh, initially introduced to the site by you.
Yeah.
No, thanks.
One of the really constructive things that I've done with great pleasure.
It's been a great run these last 4 years at Blogging Heads.
Yeah. So I made this remark about how it hasn't been, in all ways, a very terrific year for either of us. I can start with myself. I just had my 33rd of 35 radiation treatments for prostate cancer this morning. I'm also taking hormones, androgen depression therapy, and I had prostatectomy in July. So I had a high-risk diagnosis back in June, and decision was made to throw the kitchen sink at it, and also it's not confined to the prostate capsule, so it's not an entirely happy situation, although the treatments have not really been a big deal.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, but very sorry to hear about the condition.
And
you're getting excellent care out there.
Yes, University, UCSF hospital. It's great, and it's a terrific team of people. And if anything can be done, they'll do it. As I say, the treatments themselves have been the least of it. The hope. Wish being the father of the thought is that the treatments will have their desired and intended effect, but we shall see. And
so what happens from here? Monitoring, you continue with the radiation until you're complete. That's
almost
done.
The radiation stops on Wednesday.
Consistent monitoring.
I'm probably going to continue on hormones for an indeterminate amount of time, at least for probably for 2 years, but maybe even after that, they're...
Wow, and this is keeping the testosterone level down.
Exactly. It's like the fuel. It's keeping it's keeping the fuel the fuel away, and so the principal side effect that you experience is the experience of being menopausal. That is, you get hot flashes, which I don't recommend just for the experience value, but whatever. It's not that big a deal, and it's not that big a price to say. As the I saw one of the doctors the other day, who's the head of the radiation oncology unit, who went to Morehouse, and his uncle was the chair of religion and philosophy at Morehouse, and as he reminded me that one great orator had once remarked on the benefits of longevity and, from King's.
It has its place.
Longevity has its place.
I can't almost remember the line. Yeah, longevity has its place.
And so,
that's the mountaintop.
That's right. I've been to the mountaintop.
I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but we as a people
will get there.
We'll get to the promised
land. That's right.
Yeah,
helping the garbage workers.
So
anyway, it's
life.
We can talk a little bit about the reflections that this provokes. But you've had a really tough time.
Well, yeah, I lost my wife of 28 years, Professor Linda Thatcher Lowry, economist at Tufts University, who succumbed after a near decade-long struggle with breast cancer in September. And, you know, that's a blow.
Very serious.
And that has been, you know, that has been the event. In my past year, of course, there were many months prior to her ultimate demise during which, you know, her condition continued to worsen, and I spent, you know, my time from May on through September when she passed away as her primary caregiver with the assistance of a wonderful hospice organization here in Boston, but, you know, on a daily basis dealing with all that was entailed.
So sorry.
In her decline.
It's sad news.
Thank
sad
you.
News about it, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, thank you for your condolence. I mean, I suppose if I were going to try to say something for public consumption on the basis of that morbid introduction, I'd say that I'd give anything that my wife were still living. But I certainly cherish the time that we spent together and the opportunity that I had to share with her those months prior to her demise, and that was a life-changing, profoundly, you know, moving and experience. I mean,
life-changing.
I will never be the same. Oh. We looked death in the face. We saw this coming. This was not a surprise. We both knew that the end was nigh. And 28 years together sort of came down to day in, day out, sitting there in that bedroom because she didn't much get up out of it. Reading to her or rubbing her feet or watching the Boston Red Sox, you know, in their self-immolation over the course of the last baseball season. I grew up watching baseball as a kid. Came to think in my adulthood that it was boring, but now in my near old age, sitting with my dying wife, it was one of the great sources of joy, the rhythm of a baseball game on television and the comments back and forth between us. Or reading these philosophical books, reading Richard John Newhouse, the late priest and public intellectual, has a book out there reflecting on his own demise as it was unfolding from a stomach cancer. As I lay dying, this is Richard John Newhouse, the priest, the fellow who was close to Cardinal Ratzinger before he came became the Pope. The neocon, this is Newhouse, who kind of led a right-of-center intellectual insurgency on matters religious with some effect. And I won't go on too long about this. It's just a profound meditation on mortality. And Linda and I parsed it together, confronted with the reality of her own pending demise, watching her cling to hope, and then watching it slip away in the face of the just unrelenting reality of organ failure and pending death, watching her children, you know, dealing with spiritual matters. Linda was an agnostic, I think one may say, a probing spiritual seeker who couldn't find credulity anywhere. It was just something that I don't really want to talk casually about. It's not that I'm afraid or ashamed. It's just that I think what should be said about this should be thoughtfully constructed. I don't really know at the end of the day what the bottom line on it is. I just know that there could have been no experience like it, and I'm a different person for it.
And was she as supportive as of you as you were of her. I imagine you. She must have been very strong through this. Is that right?
She was enormously courageous, enormously steadfast and sort of disciplined and sort of determined. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was still trying to do the physical therapy exercises, I don't know, a couple of weeks before she passed away. She taught her required teaching in Tufts in the spring semester, even though she had neurosurgery over the spring break to try to grapple with one of these lesions that was getting out of hand in her brain. She timed the midterm examination, missed one class, and went on, notwithstanding the fact that she was dying of cancer. She would not allow our children to see her ebbing hopefulness. She wouldn't let it show. She wouldn't. She fought desperately against self-pity. Anyway.
So she affirmed her. This is too an insufficiently thoughtful thing. Way to put it, but I mean, she kind of affirmed the value, the importance of what she was doing as a mother, as a wife and partner with you, and as an educator. She thought that,
Josh, I don't object. I think that's a perfectly fair thing to say.
Well, I'm very sorry to.
Thank you.
Communicated about this, but only in the kind of low resolution venue of email. And,
I'm just kind of in this space of sort of confusion and grief. The light is just dim. I can't see anything clearly now. I don't know where I'm going. Mm-hmm. Or what I'm doing. I'm just trying to maintain our sons, Glenn the second, and Nehemiah, our young adults. Glenn will be 23 on his birthday. Nehemiah turned 20 day before yesterday. And, this is our family, and, just got to try to maintain, but things are very unclear for me.
Yeah, right, sort of. Very sorry to hear that, but as I'm sure Linda must have told you, you're a person of great strength and decency, and with a great deal to contribute, and have contributed a great deal, and a good friend, I should say. I should add that as well. I hope that provides some sense of at least a little light. Loved and admired by many, Glenn, including our audience here on Blogging Heads. We should
let's move on to the next topic.
move on to another topic. Like Linda, we're going to do the things that we know how to do and think are worth doing, despite the difficult circumstances. So here is a topic that I think we're both interested in a bunch of different ways, which is the Ron Paul phenomenon. Complicated phenomenon, all the more with this new added, not really new, I mean, new attention to the Ron Paul newsletters. What's your, you've been paying attention to this, what's your...
Yeah, I have been paying attention. I should say that I did a blogging head with John McWhorter just yesterday, and we discussed this too. So I might repeat myself just a little bit. We discussed this, and I'll just tell you briefly the sort of line that I took, which is that, let me just bracket for a moment this business about the mm-hmm. newsletters and Paul's, potential racism, anti-Semitism. Not that that's a minor issue, but And it doesn't, in my mind, determine fully how I want to react to the phenomenon of Ron Paul. I want us to deal with that, but I want that not to be the way in which I frame my response to Paul, because I think he should be taken seriously. I think libertarianism is a serious position. They're wrong in my view about a lot of stuff, but they're serious. Okay, that the issues that are involved are of fundamental import, and that to just brush it away with the back of your hand is intellectually, sort of childish in my mind to do. Oh, he's a libertarian. I can't listen to that. I think that the kind of things that Ron Paul has had to say about economic policy are harebrained and shouldn't be taken seriously. You know, abolish the Fed, return to the gold standard. I mean, this is a kind of Austrian economic, ideology or, whatever that I don't think should be allowed any space in the management of practical affairs. It'll ruin us. I think that Paul's questioning about what's the purpose of the American global military footprint, why do we have a Navy and Air Reaction, why are we going constantly to war, deserves to be answered and not dismissed out of hand as something that, you can't say that in the Republican primary. I mean, it really infuriates me that these journalists will cover him and they will say, oh, that's a terrible thing to say in Iowa. Not that it's wrong. Please, will you give me an argument?
Right.
And when Paul stands at these debates and he says, why do you want to go bomb Iran? Why do you want to go bomb Iran? Have you thought that went through? And people respond with this kind of pat, sort of outbidding each other for who can be the most anti-Islamist and who can be the most slavishly pro and unthoughtfully pro-Israel. It just drives me up the wall.
Let's pause for somebody
tell me why he's wrong about the fact that we ought to go to war with Iran, et cetera. So, the welfare state in the hands of a libertarian ideologue is not my idea of how to go forward in the 21st century with the federal government. I'm not voting for him for president, but I think he's an important figure on the scene right now, and I really welcome his, contribution to the political discussion.
Two things. I generally agree with your framing of the issue, but two qualifications. First, the stuff in the newsletters is disgusting and awful.
I've heard.
I'll just stipulate to the fact that he didn't write it, that he didn't know about it. I find it harder to understand how that was possible. I mean, people who read the newsletters at the time always got the impression that the stuff was written by him. That's what Don Black, who runs the website Stormfront, which is a basically David Duke kind of Nazi website. He said, I read this stuff. I thought Ron Paul wrote it. That's certainly how it was presented, and what it means for Ron Paul to say that he takes moral responsibility for what was said, but it's no basis for judging him or anything he thinks. I don't understand exactly what that means. The thing about it, though, is that this was the stuff that's in the newsletters was, whether assume it wasn't written by him, it was very much the product of a, as people have been saying, of a conscious decision, a very deliberate decision on the part of certain elements in the libertarian movement to find a basis of alliance with a kind of hard nationalist right. People from the von Mises Institute and Murray Rothbard, Lou Rockwell and Murray Rothbard. This was a political strategy to strengthen the libertarianism by finding allies. I find it even harder to believe that Ron Paul wasn't part of that, part of the strategic decision making about building this alliance. But there's I think the intellectual question that we face, or an intellectual question we face, is: do we learn something about the kind of libertarianism that Ron Paul endorses from the fact that there could be this alliance between the Ron Paul style libertarians and people who are, you know, hanging around the Stormfront, who are very big Ron Paul supporters? Does that tell us something about libertarianism, that there was a that alliance was possible? And I think we do learn something. Right? You know, there are some people who are against the government doing stuff because they have a kind of strongly principled set of convictions about limited government, and some people who are against the government doing stuff because they think that the government is going to assist people who they despise because they're racists, for example. And that's as I see it, that's the basis of the basis of the alliance. So even if Ron Paul didn't himself write these things, I think it's an unhappy feature of the kind of libertarianism that he does endorse, that that there could be that alliance with these people who are really the worst elements in American society. But the other thing that I think is...
Hold on just a minute, Josh, if I may. Okay, because this is about associations, and it, of course, takes me back to the anti-Obama arguments made about his associations. And I want to know, what do I learn about a left liberal from the fact that he may have close relationships with radical, sort of separatist-thinking, Afrocentric firebrands or bomb-throwing, anarchistic, whether underground-affiliated, whatever. And I somehow recall, I don't want to attribute this to you personally, but many, many people saying, well, you learn nothing from that. So what's the difference? Yeah. Or I've got a socialist who, it turns out, is in some organization that has some communist connections and ties in the 1930s or the 1940s. And now here comes this person, and we uncover that, 20 years ago when they were in college or when they were organizing with this labor union or whatever, they went to meetings, they hung out, they distributed pamphlets, they were part of something, and these people were taking the orders from Moscow, et cetera.
Yeah, a couple of things. I think it's a fair question about, do you learn something about Obama from the fact that he was hanging around, palling around.
That he sat in Jeremiah Wright's church.
For all those years.
Of course, I don't think there's anything wrong with Jeremiah Wright, but most people do.
And in the case of Ron Paul, first of all, and this isn't quite an answer to the question, but the alliance is close. These were newsletters with Ron Paul's name on them, from which he was making a good bit of income. And it was a very self-conscious political strategy adopted by people who Ron Paul was very, very close with. I mean, Lou Rockwell, was the head of his staff when he was first in Congress. I think it was when he was first entering the early 1980s. So this is a very self-conscious political decision to broaden the attractiveness of libertarianism by allying with a bunch of with the worst forms of American racism, which is what makes Ron Paul so attractive to people who hang around at Stormfront on the website. And if you look at the website, you'll see how much enthusiasm there is there for Ron Paul. So the alliance is very, very close and part of a deliberate political strategy, the paleo-libertarian strategy. When Obama was... I think the Reverend Wright case is much more analogous than the Bill Ayers case. Bill Ayers was well past his weatherman years, and the association wasn't very close. And he was not endorsing weathermen views at the time, whereas this, you know, these in these newsletters there is this endorsement of the most vile kinds of racism and homophobia. So if that said, Obama had a decision to make about Jeremiah Wright, and he was, for better or worse, you know, as somebody said, he threw his grandmother under the bus. He distanced himself sharply from the views of Reverend Wright. And one of the things that Ron Paul has not done at all is to have distanced himself from the people who were, you know, who were writing this stuff. So I, you know, I think Obama took a much stronger position about you know, moving away from those the views of Reverend Wright. So I think there are some significant differences between the cases. But I wanted to go for a minute to this other thing that you mentioned. You talked about two features of Ron Paul's views, one of which you're more sympathetic, which is the anti-intervention views on foreign policy, the other of which you're not at all sympathetic with, which is the views about, you know, abolishing the Fed, the economic views. So I think for Ron Paul, and I think there's a real challenge here, there's a kind of connection, there's a strong connection between those two views. Basically, because the case, I'm sure there's an economic case that he's got about abolishing the Fed and, you know, against fiat money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a political case. The political case goes something like this. You start with Lord Acton's dictum, you know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely, and there's probably some, you know, monotone increasing function as power increases, corruption increases, or something like that. So the more power you got, the more corrupting it is. And so you build a big government, and it's going to be corrupt. And one of the kinds of corruption that it's going to go in for is military adventures overseas. And then there's a problem. And so you want to have a standing army, so you're going to go in for military adventures overseas. But then there's a problem, which is how do you go about paying for the wars? And the way you go for the way you pay for the wars is to turn on the printing presses. And now run the argument in reverse. If you don't want the intervention, I think the Ron Paul argument. If you don't want that kind of foreign policy, then what you have to do is not just argue case by case against the policy. You have to eliminate the capacity to engage in that policy. This goes back to the Acton point. So if the capacity is there, it's going to be abused. So you got the capacity to intervene. People are going to end up doing it. So what you have to do is eliminate the capacity. And one way to eliminate the capacity to conduct this expansionist foreign policy, this kind of imperial foreign policy, is to prevent the government from, you know, printing the money that's required to pay for the policy. So there's and if you don't accept that solution to the if you don't accept that constraint on the capacity to intervene, don't let the government print the money that's needed to do it, then you got to have some other way of saying how you propose seriously to limit the power to make war the wars that are inevitably the inevitable product of having the capacity to make war. So I think that's, I'm not sure if that's the only, I'm sure that's not the only argument that Ron Paul has about
It seems no argument at all to me, Josh, I must say. I mean, because it seems to say that, I mean, why just limit it to monetary policy? What about taxation? I mean, you know, you don't have to print money. You can raise the money by taxing the incomes of the citizens. To argue that we should do away, as I think Ron Paul may actually argue, with the Internal Revenue Service.
Right.
Because they might use the money to go to war. Well, they also might use it to build roads or to...
Now we're getting to the heart of the matter.
Health service
to
poor people.
So, but he's consistent on this.
And likewise, the monetary authority might be helpful at stemming a financial panic or providing a lender of last resort or injecting liquidity into an otherwise, problematic situation. I mean, these are real things.
I agree on all of that, and on the tax side, yes, that's why Ron Paul likes 10% taxes, likes flat taxes, wants to get rid of progressive taxation. The general point is that power is inevitably going to be abused. That's the Acton point. And so the only way to prevent the abuse is to limit the power. And there are lots of ways to do that. Abolishing the Fed, preventing the printing presses from running is one way to do that. Limiting taxes is another way to do it. Eliminating regulatory agencies is another way to do that, constitutionally decentralizing so that there isn't, there's more power to do stuff in states but not at the federal level. Those are all part of a strategy of preventing an accumulation of power that is, following Acton's dictum, inevitably going to lead to corruption. Now, you and me, what you're doing is not only eliminating the capacity to do bad stuff, you're also eliminating the capacity to do a bunch of good stuff. Now,
both think that. And furthermore, I think we could talk about means or we could talk about ends. Eliminating the capacity of the government to accumulate the resources to pursue bad ends is dealing with means. But then there also should be an argument about the ends. So Paul's position, what are you doing with the Navy in every ocean? How do you think the Chinese feel when they look over their wall and they see your Navy cruising in their backyard? Suppose their Navy were cruising in the Caribbean. And when he says, exactly how much of your treasure are you going to pour into this imperial project?
But here's why the question...
To me, that's a question about ends. Let me just finish. He deserves an answer. I haven't yet heard a cogent answer.
Right. So, but here's the thing on this, Glenn. I agree with you. There's an argument about ends and an argument about means. And the argument that I was just making, absolutely right, was not an argument about the principles according to which you should use power, either domestically or overseas. It was a kind of, you gotta limit the power in order to make sure that it's not abused. But we haven't talked about what are the good uses and what are the bad uses. But here's, I think, the thing that one of the ways in which I think Ron Paul represents a challenge for people who don't like intervention very much, which is, and it goes back to this point about how do you avoid the abuse of the power, which is... you don't like the bad wars, the interventionary wars overseas.
Yeah.
You can argue, and we've tried to do this case by case against the bad wars, the Iraq war, maybe the beginning in late 2001, the Afghan war, the Vietnam war. We argue against them case by case, and as a general matter, we lose. I don't think we've lost all the time. I think if it hadn't been for the anti-war movement, there would have been a war in Central America in the mid-1980s. But, putting that history to the side, generally we lose those arguments. There's another strategy for preventing the bad ones from happening. or the bad domestic policies like the drug war. It's another strategy for preventing them from happening, which is you eliminate the capacity to conduct those policies. And you may thereby eliminate the capacity to do some good, but the alternative strategy of fighting case by case against, you know, foreign adventures, against imperial wars, has its own downside. And then the downside is that the opponents of, from the point of view of opponents of those policies, the opponents of those policies typically lose, almost always lose. That, I think, is the... That's why I think there's a real... That's where the I think there's a real challenge that comes from Ron Paul, despite the...
Okay. You know, I agree with you about that, and I'll accept your formulation that, you know, a libertarian critique might end up settling upon means motivated by views about ends, but, you know, more fundamentally motivated by the knowledge that if we can get the means minimalized and we keep the state in its cage, we keep the state from running rampant, whether it be on a global level or with respect to, you know, supervision over supervision of its own citizens. What do I want to say here? I listened to Ron Paul, like, in that last Iowa debate, and he's up there on the stage vituperating about, you know, all of these wars and about why are we going to war with Iran and whatnot. And I'm thinking, you know, we've gotten to the place where now we, as a nation, consume this kind of, you know, sort of belligerence and a warlike vibe. You know, we're taking out, right? I mean, we are cheerleading for the taking out of the president of the United States. Brags about how many he has killed. Okay. And we are, you know, we got Osama bin Laden. I mean, this kind of thing. This seems corrupting to me in the extreme. And somehow or another, I just might be wrong about this, I see a connection between a individually focused, you know, philosophy, a libertarian philosophy, a philosophy that, you know, sort of comes out of a sort of abiding respect for, reverence indeed, for the prerogatives of persons. I see a suspicion of this kind of nationalistic bellicosity as at least a cousin to a focus on liberty and a kind of individual centric focus. And yet you're telling me that he's hanging out with right wing you know, sort of proto nationalist types who I imagine would be all behind America going and bombing everybody everywhere. So I don't know, maybe
Well, I don't think these are the for America bombing everybody everywhere, but I think they are indifferent to, in fact, worse than indifferent. I think that they're, you know, these are white, you know, they line up with white nationalists, people who are at best indifferent and more typically hostile to, antipathetic to the good of lots of people in the country, in this country.
I want to ask you something else because we're going to run out of time eventually. And that's about the Civil Rights Act in 1964. Yeah. Okay, now this became something of an issue, I guess, when Rand Paul was running for the Senate in Kentucky. I actually can't cite Ron Paul's sort of history of statements, chapter and verse, but I can certainly recall libertarian arguments to the effect that that's an undue imposition by the government on the rights of property and association that people should be should have. And I have to tell you, look, I'm an African American. I believe in civil rights. I'm glad that the Civil Rights Act of 1960, the Civil Rights Movement, et cetera, et cetera. But I've always thought that there was something to that position. And the point I'm trying to make, the position being a concern about the overriding of individual liberties associated with the state's project of trying to rid society of prejudicial feeling and behavior that is injurious to a protected category, a class, historically discriminated minority, or whatever it might be. a concern that when I decide to open up a business, I should be able to decide who I want to do business with and who I don't want to do business with. That should be my liberty, this kind of view. Now, that's not my view, but I see it as my business, if I have another view, to deal with that view. You know what I mean? To explain, to make the argument, to take the additional step. Yes, you're right. This is an imposition on liberty. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 is an imposition on people's liberty in the interest of a higher historical and political project. Okay? And that argument needs to be made. So, you know, the tendency to kind of associate with a person like Ron Paul, these, you know, these views are unacceptable, you know, it's a kind of gotcha politics, a kind of, you know, he's got bad character because he thought this, and not to make an argument, strikes me as the wrong way to go.
I agree about that, and it's we talked about it in the case of Rand Paul. With Ron Paul, I mean, he was, you know, when there was the resolution to, you know, commemorate, if that's the right word, the passage of this.
Oh, you and I talked about it?
Yeah, about Rand Paul. We didn't talk about it with Ron Paul. With Ron Paul, I mean, he voted against, I think it was in 2004, there was a 40th anniversary resolution about the Civil Rights Act of 64, and he was against it. I mean, you know, it's part of it's part of a package of policies for him. He doesn't like laws that protect women or anybody else, but women in particular, from sexual harassment at work. He thinks that women, this is a book in 87 that he presented this case, that women who, you know, if you don't quit when the sexual harassment starts, that you're complicit in the harassment. He didn't like federal funding of AIDS research because he thought that this was partly the consequence of a lifestyle decision. So there was an individual responsibility issue there. He doesn't like funding for education because he doesn't think that there's a right to education. I think in the case of each of those things, I mean, in the case of sexual harassment, there is a very strong liberty issue there on the part of the victim of the harassment. Why does somebody who's working in a place have to quit the job in order to get away from some kind of wrong, inappropriate behavior that the person shouldn't have to deal with in the first place? In the case of education, I mean, if you value the importance of people having some kind of control over their lives, and one of the most fundamental ways in which people get control, it's not there from the beginning, you need education in order to, you know, take some kind of control.
I'm with you, Josh. Preach it to the choir.
Yeah, no, I know.
I say I'm not a libertarian.
Yeah, you said there needs to be an argument. I think these are, and by the way, the points I'm making are in the case of education. This is not, I'm putting the point in terms of the importance of liberty. That's why you fund education. Why you tax people in order to support education is because you think liberty is sufficiently important and education sufficiently important to liberty it's not restricting liberty in the name of some, you know, collective project or something like that. I mean, it's partly restricting liberty in the name of ensuring that people are in a position to exercise some kind of meaningful control over their lives. Okay. So, but I agree with you the points need to be answered and not lazed about. And I think that to go back to the more general point, I think there's a very powerful temptation because of this completely corrupt and degraded political alliance that shows up in the content of these newsletters in the early 1990s. That's an it makes it easy to dismiss Ron Paul, but I do think for people who don't like you and me, you don't like the drug war, you don't like mass incarceration, you don't like you know, the control of the politics in the country by big banks. You don't like all kinds of, you know, foreign adventures, which are pretty much freed from political control. And there's Ron Paul saying all of this stuff, and it's and saying a bunch of things that that very few Democrats say. I mean, you know, there's not a lot of Democratic opposition to the drug war, not a lot of Democratic opposition to mass incarceration, not a lot of Democratic opposition to foreign adventures. And so then you have, I think it's, so it's incumbent both to answer, I agree with you, intellectually to answer the libertarian views, but then to come back to the point that I was making about the link between between money and intervention, it's incumbent on people who don't like intervention and don't like drug wars, et cetera, to have an alternative answer to the line of argument that I described before, which is if you don't like those things, then what you have to do is adopt this extreme limited government view, which is going to disable the state from doing all these things that you don't like. You have to have some other way to make sure that it's directed to purposes, you know, to appropriate purposes, if you think, as we both do, that there are lots of important purposes that the state has. If the state has important purposes, but then there is this problem about you build a bunch of capacity, and then the capacity is going to be misused.
But what about Paul's, you know, I've heard him say it on a number of occasions, well, why don't we just return to the constitutional requirement that the Congress has to declare war before the president wages?
Well, I'm all for that. The problem is, and this is, I mean, taking up the challenge seriously, that point has been made over and over and over, and it just doesn't seem to take hold.
More power has continued to accrue to the executive.
More power has, the national security state built after World War II has continued to grow, and Obama has done nothing to stanch the tide there. And there's something about, build it and it'll be abused. And so the only way to prevent its abuse is by not having it around to be abused. Well, if you think it's important that it be around because there's a bunch of good stuff that needs to get done, then
defending us from real enemies.
Yeah, defending us from real enemies, or on the domestic side, you know, building bridges and building serious infrastructure, and making sure that there's fair equality of opportunity, and et cetera. Ensuring a fair society, you think that can't happen without an affirmative state, then you have to have this is the challenge of Ron Paul. You need a politics, not just policies, you need a politics that has some promise to direct those capacities in the right direction. That, I think, is the big challenge, and why the stuff about the newsletters shouldn't tempt people to a quick dismissal. Anyway,
Why don't we conclude now? I think we're almost at 50 minutes on. And,
okay.
There are other things to do, but we should have another conversation. So Blogging Heads is going through some changes, but Cohen and Lowry will continue to talk from time to
okay,
time.
Okay, very good to talk, Glenn. Again,
same here.
Most importantly, my condolences about your late wife.
Thank you very much, Josh. Okay, good to talk to you, and good luck going forward with your treatments.
Bye-bye.
Bye.